So I'm not hearing anybody saying that it really is a war on terrorism. But I'd like to, I know I'd like to hear more, because you keep, we're talking about continuities, and I recognize, how could one not, as an American historian, recognize the continuities from the Palmer raids or from the internment, or the know-nothings for that matter, let's say. How do we define this administration's policies, the ones we're focused on, or more generally, in the context of the right-wing or conservative tradition, all of which is language we don't use that often in American politics? And I want to push this because I recognize very strong conservative traditions in American politics, specifically Republican Party traditions, more than Democratic, because the Democratic Party was the great conservative party in America for much of the 19th century, right? Republican conservatism historically does not look anything like this to me. That's all I want to say. It is Warren G. Harding that lets Debs out of jail and brings him to the White House. It is Charles Evans Hughes. I'm not speaking as a Republican. I'm just commenting. Who overturns, okay? But so don't, you know. It's Charles Evans Hughes, not FDR, that overturns the Roosevelt Corollary and goes to Latin America and says, we are going to recognize your sovereign nations. So for me, the Jacobinical, or I would say Bolshevik, I'm with Brzezinski on this, I would say Bolshevik, not Jacobin, but whatever, same thing. The Jacobinical quality is the breaking with the traditions of the American right itself. That's meant as a provocation. What do we mean by right? Is that...
Well, presumably it's a small government. And yet if you look at what the Bush administration is doing, at least with regard to internal security questions, it's growing. And certainly the executive is growing at the expense of Congress, at the expense of the judiciary. It's eliminating oversight. And presumably this is, you know, from the perspective of the traditional Robert Taft, who was always concerned right after World War II with limiting the American government, you've got a serious break in terms of civil liberties. But I think you can also see it, you know, you've left out Richard Nixon. There are a lot of other traditions within the American Republican Party, and certainly there is a tradition of secrecy and of avoiding as much as possible sort of legal limits on what the government can do.
I don't want to defend Richard Nixon, but it seems to me that Richard Nixon fits the mold of a American conservative much better than these people. It is true with the Watergate business and his response to certain aspects of radical opposition to the war. But he worked within institutions. He worked very much within institutions, international and national. He was, in his own way, a rather political, in fact, overwhelmingly political person. I don't get the sense that Bush, except for a certain kind of electoral cunning, is a political person working with the institutions and political forces that are both national and national. That sounds to me like a conservative or maybe just a smart politician. That this is actually someone who has, as an American, but has spent a good deal of time in parts of the world where there are coups, said, you guys don't realize we had a coup in this country. And I'm not sure I want to say that. But, you know, it really, this doesn't feel at all like what a conservative, even as bad as a character Richard Nixon was, would have done.
Well, I mean, conservatism has many faces, just as, you know, liberalism does, it seems to me, in our context. And one face of conservatism from time to time has been jingoism. I mean, I think particularly around the time of the turn of the last century. And that has resurfaced, it seems to me, in this crowd. There is this great certainty that we have the answers, and a great confidence that those answers can be imposed on others. Now, that's not my sense of what an authentic conservatism ought to represent, but it is what conservatives have espoused, at least from time to time in our history, and I think that that's, that again, both the event of 9/11 and the particular set of ideologues who I think do provide much of the energy to this administration, they're jingoes.
I think I might want to throw another term out. I mean, it seems to me, beginning with Reagan, that a certain part of the Republican Party in this country developed, and even some of the neoconservatives went along with this, a kind of right-wing populism. And I think that may be a bit of what we're seeing. And I think there's a great division within the Republican Party, and we still see it. I mean, there are only a few of the so-called Northeastern Republicans who have any visibility at all. But I think that this kind of right-wing populism, which plays on jingoism and a number of other things, but at the same time is enriching often cronies, peronism, whatever you want, I think we are seeing something that seems massively contradictory to me, but nonetheless, there are elements of this, I think, very much at work in the so-called new right that has emerged, largely out of, well, all of those pink states. It's a little surprising in the Midwest, but in other parts of the Bush geography.
But it's interesting you say contradiction, because I'm thinking of like so many contradictions going through my mind, but one of them on this point is how they get away with it when so much is being outsourced. Jobs are outsourced. This military stuff is being outsourced. You know, there is such a lack of patriotism all the time. They're banging the drums of patriotism that I don't understand how this washes in what they call the heartland. I really don't, you know, unless it be all these cultural factors, you know, that relate back to a mythical tradition, you know, invented traditions. And that, to come to the Nazi analogy, was something that did work there, you know. I mean, the opening of Triumph of the Will is something that gives even me goosebumps, you know. There's medieval Nuremberg representing German tradition, you know, medieval, all the medieval qualities they think are good things, you know, honesty and craftsmanship and blah, blah, blah. And then Leni Riefenstahl's brilliant film shows an airplane coming over. So they have all these wonderful traditional virtues and modern power. You know, when the shadow of the plane goes over Nuremberg. And that's a very seductive combination. You know, old folk songs playing in the background, you know, that remind everybody of their childhood. That's a very seductive combination. And the idea of looking for a popular base for very narrow, elitist material objectives is one of the things that does evoke sort of an analogy, you know, bring analogy to mind.
Well, I think it's something that has been happening since the 1960s. I mean, what we're looking at is a political shift of the American mainstream quite definitely over to the right. And in a sense, one could, you know, you see Nixon putting together his sort of backlash constituency, which is a large piece of opposing what happened in the 60s, the black liberation movement, certainly. There's a racist element here. Then opposition to changes within the family and a loosening of culture, you know, traditional cultural norms. So that that is something that's picked up and used politically by the Republican Party. You see it solidified by Reagan, I think, in the 1980s. And so Bush has inherited something that has been going on for quite a while and resonates with a lot of voters on a cultural level. You know, there's and there are code words that are used here, like law and order, like family values, that I think people vote on, that people aren't necessarily thinking always about their economic circumstances, I think because they feel so powerless at this point.
But yeah. I think I'm seeing the landscape differently, but I mean, in a cultural sense, it seems to me that politics have shifted to the left since the 1960s. And that it is that fact that helps to then fix the heartland, if you would, to this right wing, which actually pursues policies contrary to the interests of everyday folk, that President Bush basically can stand up and say, you know, they're going to foist gay marriage on you. And you're out there in Kansas, and you say, oh, my golly, gee whiz, that's a terrible thing. I guess I better vote for President Bush because he's going to make sure that doesn't happen. Now, the people in the Bush White House, in fact, in my judgment, could care less about most of these issues, whether it's abortion or gay rights or changes in the family. But it's a great disciplinary tool for ensuring that the people who are losing their jobs because they're being shipped abroad don't vote consistent with might be their economic interests, but are so fearful of what they see as a leftward cultural shift that they stupidly stick with the right. Is that, but tell me why we are seeing shift so
differently. Well, because I see, the politicians playing on language. In other words, language about, say, affirmative action is considered, and has been really since the 1970s, used as a kind of code word here. And the people who have power, political power, are people who have played upon a fear of ordinary people losing their jobs to affirmative action and things like that.
But it seems that we are actually giving an identical explanation of the political dynamic. Mm-hmm. But what I'm arguing is that they're able to play on these fears because their fears are, to some degree, real. I mean, there is something called, I'm not judging affirmative action. There really is affirmative action.
There were changes.
About backlash. You're talking about backlash.
Yeah, there were changes in the 1960s. Right, nobody's denying that. Mm-hmm.
But see, I think this is where we might be able to find some disagreement here. See, I don't agree at all that the mainstream American politics has moved to the right. I don't think you would build this jerry-rigged, but, and to a significant extent, fixed, institutionally fixed. I mean, in Florida. I meant through constant massive suppression of core Democratic Party constituencies. So a jerry-rigged right-wing populist thing that has inched its way to narrow control of Congress, of judiciary, of what they wanted for 40 years. I don't think you would do that. You don't do that from the mainstream. You're trying to take over the mainstream. But I think the mainstream moved in fundamental ways, maybe not always, but in fundamental ways, as far as I can recognize, to the left. I don't mean just the culture, but I mean, fundamental axes of our society. It is not the faces of power, and I don't mean just face in a representational sense. I mean in what you look at on the streets, in your school, in the military, are radically different than they were 50 years ago, and that is what people are seeing. That's what fuels this right-wing populist backlash. So my analysis, and that would in turn point to why this may be, a radical break, because they've had to force this. There's a culmination. I'm saying all of this has been in process, but the culmination that we've now been living through for 3.5 years or whatever, that's the break. But that's just a thought.
I'd like to ask the Americanists a question, if I may. Because, this question of where is the mainstream?
Right here.
Half the population doesn't vote.
Right.
Could you tell me why that is? And is that a decline from prior voter participation? And if so, isn't that a message too? And what message is it?
The decline, just statistically, goes back to the very late 19th century. It's been a constant decline with a brief moment of an upswing with Al Smith in the Roosevelt administration bringing immigrants into the voting booths, and then it continued. But as a secular decline, it's a very long time thing. So there are obviously many factors in it as a result, including, which we forget, is a lot of, and what happened in Florida is that only a graphic and appalling case of something that happens almost accidentally in other places, including New York, and that is various forms of ways in which people become ineligible to vote. And we vastly underestimate how many people really can't vote for one reason or another, whether they've moved and not registered, whether they are not citizens often. There's a whole series of things. There have been a number of these studies that sort of say that we exaggerate the degree to which lack of interest as opposed to some kind of blocking of access to voting. Although, you're right, there's been a great decline, which I suppose historians would conventionally say the reason people don't vote is neither party or parties available aren't offering them anything to vote for. That is, beyond these other obstacles that are there. So I don't know the answer. Maybe my other Americans do.
The $64 million question, right? Mm. I think it's much, I mean, I think there's that, but I think it's a larger question of political culture. But that's, I think it's we have an anti-politics political culture which transcends any particular regime, but that's a quick thought.
Well, I think that's really important. I want to go back to the, and I think it's related to what we were talking about a moment ago, and that is the kind of linguistic battle that the Republicans, or a certain part of the Republican Party, has won. Affirmative action was designed to achieve some degree of racial equality and gender equality in this society. So what do the Republicans do? They say that affirmative action is completely at odds with our tradition of equality. And likewise, family values, a whole series of linguistic victories that have been achieved, which are, I don't think you can underestimate how unusual that is for the American right to have done. I still remember Lionel Trilling's introduction to the liberal imagination in 1950 says, here, I have to critique liberalism from the inside because conservatism is nothing but a partially inaudible grunt or some phrase like that. Things have changed a great deal, and there's been a great deal of complacency on the other side, I think, in allowing so many what really are, I think, core values that can be shared over a very wide domain, sort of possessed by a particular agenda.